Hey guys, Tim Fitzpatrick here, and you're listening to Hey Can I Come Over? Each week, or as often as time allows, I will rudely invite myself over to someone's house, insist they make me dinner to my particular diet specifications, and force them to answer as many personal questions as I can manage in an hour or so. My guest today is a dear friend of mine who currently shapes the minds of impressionable youth as a history teacher at Eastport South Manor School District. He's also been a bandmate of mine for several years, although we've both kind of taken a musical hiatus at the moment. Everyone, please welcome the man who has given me countless interesting pieces of information about my hometown, Mr. Bob Fleming. Bob, it's lovely to have you on the show. What did you make for dinner today?
For dinner, we have chili. What is it called, though?
Black bean chili? Maybe?
Black bean chili. Vegetarian, of course.
Of course. It better be.
It's black beans, like seven spices from the other side of the world. Peppers.
Chocolate.
There were like 15 ingredients.
It's black bean and chocolate.
Oh, chocolate's in there, too. Tomatoes. You know, and I know, like, cumin and sassafras and stuff.
There's no sassafras.
I just wanted to say sassafras. It's very good, though.
It was fantastic. I really enjoyed it. You also made kale chips from your own personal garden.
Yeah, we bought six plants of kale, and squirrels got to two of them. Normally, they get to one. Mm-hmm. They always get at least one. This year, they got two, so they must be evolving, but they got two. So we salvaged four kale plants, and yeah, we made kale chips.
And they were great. Also, I really enjoyed it. Normally, like, I've had the store bought kind,
mm-hmm.
and they're decent, but like those were ridiculously fresh and really good, and just salted enough. So it was awesome. I guess I should mention. Bob's wife, Allison, is also in, and she'll probably chime in every once in a while should you not know the answer to a question that I have. Allison is bound to know it. We are also drinking. Gosh, what haven't we drank already?
Well, first was the stout, right? That was the one that I got.
Clown Shoes.
Vampire Slayer. Vampire Slayer, yeah.
And that was an Imperial Stout, and you got that at Hoptron, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we went with the Lagunitas Wilco Tango Foxtrot, WTF, which I'm currently finishing, but Bob is about to get to. This is recommended to me by the beer distributor Thrifty right off of Vets Highway. I think it's like either Julia Goldbach or Louis Kasu.
Oh, that place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's from Speakeasy, and it is called Scarface, and we'll let you know as we consume it how it is. All right, before we get really started, I wanted to Bob, thanks again for being on the podcast.
My pleasure.
You are a very soon to be father.
Yeah,
and I know it's getting apparently this is your last class today. Last test today.
Well, my last class, my last session class with students was, I think, God, that was last week,
mm-hmm.
maybe Wednesday of last week, I think a week ago. And today was the Regents, 11th grade Regents, and then we have to grade it. So I've been done teaching students in a classroom setting for a week.
But you probably still have about another week to go.
The 21st is traditionally the last day.
Okay.
But this year, because of Hurricane Sandy, we have so many days to make up, and if you want to count the blizzard as well, we lost like two or three days for that. So we have all these days to make up. The 21st is normally the last final day. You go in, you get your paycheck, and sign out. We have to come back the 24th. I'm not so upset as I should be, because
You're done. Like, there's nothing else for you to do, right? You're probably right. Just, like, filing and shit.
No, it kind of erodes. It fades away. Like, mm-hmm. You know, every day that goes by, there's less responsibilities. And then, you know, you finish your grades, you pack up. Normally, I'd be upset to say, like, oh, man, I have to come back on Monday, the 24th, to do this nonsense seminar that the district set up for us. Well, they have to make up the day, you know, that we lost. They have to make it up, according to New York State. Students are gone, so it's got to be a workshop. Normally, I'd be upset, but check this out. It turns out that the seminar is a two-hour workshop presented by a woman who has spent years earning her doctorate. She's been studying why teachers engage in sexual relationships with their students.
Wow.
And she's coming to talk to us for 2 hours. I assume it's a lesson on how not to have sex with your students.
Yes.
So I could only hope that
I mean, 2 hours of being like, hey, don't do it. That's disgusting.
What could you do for 2 hours? Like, can't you sum that up in 5 minutes?
Five
seconds?
This is a fucking child. Like, don't do that. But I guess you're sitting down for 2 hours, and she's going to, I guess, get into the research of the kind of research that she did. Like,
well, that's my point. Is that it's
some heavy shit. Dude.
It's going to be interesting, you know. So yeah. If I have to come in for one more day, let's go out with a bang.
Slightly worth it.
Yeah. Well, I might learn something, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Might learn something.
Going back to you being a.
What's the best part?
Oh, the name of the professor or the presenter.
Oh, I can't wait.
Dr. Shakeshaft.
Seriously?
Look it up. It's real. Dr. Shakeshaft. Shakeshaft.
Oh boy.
It's not a joke. It's real. Everyone look it up right now. Go. Open a new tab.
Listeners, please. Yeah. All right, going back to you being a soon to be father. Your son, his name is going to be Robert Fleming IV.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
How do you feel? You pumped? You nervous? Combination of both?
Yeah, actually, it's like 50-50.
Yeah.
You know, extremes. One minute you're just so excited. You want your child to enjoy the same things that you enjoy, the same movies and parks and roller coasters and music, and then you go to bed and your mind starts racing and you start to second guess yourself and you start to think, well, will my shortcomings?
Doesn't like Radiohead.
Yeah. What if he doesn't like King Ka? What will I do then? Well, you start to worry about your own shortcomings and if that will be inherited by the child. And
right. And Allison, are you excited?
Sure.
Yeah.
Nervous
about what, the actual birth?
No.
That's nothing.
I'm worried about after. Mm-hmm. We don't know how to take care of a baby.
Oh, yeah. No, the birth will be fine. It's afterwards. That's
you guys have been taking care of dogs for years. It couldn't be that much different, right?
Yeah. Just got to feed them twice a day from the basement. Get out the dog food from the basement. And
stop them from licking you.
Put their food in a bowl, make them sit, and whistle when they're allowed to.
Should be all right.
And I'm just going to quickly touch on your students this year. Any fun, interesting stories? Because I know you generally have like one or two every year. There's always that one student who does this super ridiculous thing. Anything that stood out this year?
This year in particular, I'm trying to think. This is kind of a rough year. I don't know if I have anything from this year.
What do you mean by rough?
Well, every year you get different students, so it's kind of a gamble. You don't know what kind of students you're going to get. This year, challenging, tough to motivate. And then when you're preoccupied with that, then you kind of don't notice the silly things, I guess.
The nuances of each. You probably notice all the personalities still.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you walk a fine line, though, when you ask me. You ask me stories that stand out, anything funny. Mm-hmm. It's a fine line, though, because on one hand, you want to laugh when a kid says something. On the other hand, you want to cry because you want to think, like, how do you not know that? Like, for example...
Like, you're going to be tested on this.
Like, I had a girl ask me... well, let me back up.
Sure.
First of all, like, I have a censored version of Saving Private Ryan, and most kids really love it. Like, you know, they earn this respect for veterans that they never had before, and they learn so much about World War II. And then... I tried to think of a higher order question, engaging critical thinking. So there's this scene where the German soldier is captured, you know, after the medic dies, and there's this big moral dilemma: should we kill him or let him go? Is he a prisoner of war? He surrendered fair and square, you know. So I'm trying to get the kids to really think critically. Guys, this German soldier, he surrendered, you know, he's a prisoner of war. It's a war crime. If you execute him, what would you do? I mean, he just killed your best friend, but, you know, he was just doing his job. And this girl raises her hand, and I think she's going to ask this deep, answer this deep question, you know, say something really epic. And she says, what does surrender mean?
Oh no!
And at first I thought she was joking, but then you could see that she was not. And you know, as a professional, you have to answer her question. Mm-hmm. She doesn't know, so you have to educate her. So I told her what it means, but it was just like wah wah.
That's got to be it. That's probably a pretty big letdown, especially considering like you're pretty into World War II in general, right?
I spend more time on it than I should in the classroom. Like, I spent like 3 weeks on World War II. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good one. Well, not a good one, but it's a good lesson.
What exactly sparked your passion for history? Because obviously, outside of your profession, you're still obsessed.
Yeah.
With history.
Yeah.
Currently, obviously, no one on the podcast can see this, but you're wearing a Robert E. Lee t-shirt saying most likely to secede, which is fantastic. So obviously this is more than just a job to you. Where did this come from?
I think I was just born with it, because even when I was preschool, before public school, I was always reading something. I couldn't leave the house without at least like 5 books in the car. I always had to be reading something, and it was usually geared towards history or maybe science, something like that. And or Care Bears, one of those three. But
insatiable hunger for history or oh man, I can't think of any names of the Care Bears right now.
There will be one eventually. They're working on it. Major universities are, are considering curriculum. Yeah, curriculum is being written for that. So my career could have gone in any direction. Yeah, science, yeah. Care Bears, or history. Just happened to be history. I guess it was after I was that age, when I got into elementary school, my dad was the first huge influence. Like, my dad... Honestly, like, my dad is, when you meet my dad, and Tim, you know my father, like, he's like a true blue-collar worker, you know, like, American dream.
Bluest collar guy.
Yeah, blue-collar, American dream, like, has his own private business, got home at like 8 o'clock at night, working pest control, termite extermination, but that's not what he was meant to do. I feel like in a different time period, maybe if he was born 20 years later, like me, I feel like he would have had the opportunity to get into a college, and he could have been a professor. He's actually an artist. Like, he's painted stuff when he was in high school. Really good stuff. So he's got this side to him that people don't know unless they sit with him and talk. And when I was a kid, of course, I would sit with him and talk a lot. You know, he would drive me to drum lessons. In fact, I think my transport to drum lessons was a big influence on my career, because that's when my dad would talk a lot about history. And he would always have these ideas for novels or screenplays. he's big into like Greek mythology, Roman history, and civil war, firearms. So I think growing up with that around me really had a huge influence. There was always like some Western on TV, something like that. So yeah, that was a big influence. Totally.
It was probably just, it was your upbringing and the influence of your father on you.
Cool. Absolutely.
Very
yeah.
cool.
And then after that, eighth grade, I had Mr. Sestero. He might have retired by the time you...
Yeah, he was gone. Well no, eighth grade was junior high.
You didn't go to OBJ.
I went to Ronkonkoma.
Okay. Yeah, I had an eighth grade teacher, Richard Sestero, who was just a great teacher. He didn't just push history on me, but also like discipline. You know, he was a no nonsense kind of guy. And in eighth grade, I was really a moron. Like picture like your average middle school idiot. That was me. So I had no direction.
You had the bleach blonde hair.
No, that was high school.
Oh, that was high school. Oh, so you. All right, so you're not considering bleach blonde hair like a part of your idiocy?
No, that was an improvement.
Okay, wow.
That was an improvement. Eighth grade was, you know, I didn't know who I was. I didn't have any sense of identity, really. Mm-hmm. Adolescence was pretty rough.
Normal eighth grade stuff.
Yeah. So between my dad and then, I guess, my eighth grade social studies teacher provided some guidance to help me.
I found a lot of my favorite teachers in general were history teachers as well. I guess, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm kind of a fan of history as well. Obviously, I never pursued a career in it or anything like that. But I would say, like, three of my top five favorite teachers were history teachers. They always seem to be, give it this way, but, like, they're the kind of guys you want to sit down and have a beer with.
Yes.
And just pick their brain.
Totally.
And, like, if I had the opportunity now, like, Mr. Maniachi in Ronkonkoma Junior High School is a big one. Super friendly guy, clearly extremely passionate, always got really excited when you had a question because he knew that, like, he was engaging you and you were interested in it and was always more than happy to talk in depth about whatever you're asking about. So, yeah, history mm-hmm. teachers, probably the coolest of the bunch. I'd say.
Well, I think it's hard to get into a passionate discussion on mathematics.
That's true. Unless you're getting deep, deep.
Yeah. Excited. Well, I mean, all the disciplines are linked, mm-hmm. you know, but still, you know, it's math.
Yeah.
No one likes math.
I mean, come on. is there a particular time period that you're the most excited about? A part of history that you just can't get enough of?
World War II is up there, mm-hmm. just because of the romanticism. I mean, as far as Americana goes, it's way up there. You know, the swing dancing and the USO shows and D-Day and the heroism from The Greatest Generation. I think it's really, it's just locked in this place in the mind of the public. I guess it's just so... Such a romantic time. I mean, you know, the realism is that a lot of people died. It was a horrible, horrible ordeal. But as far as in 2013, when our generation looks back upon it, I think we look back upon it with a lot of romanticism. And, you know, they call them the greatest generation. They survived the Great Depression. Like my grandpa Sam, who passed away last summer... You know, he was a kid during the Great Depression, and he saved up his, like, pennies. He suffered through the Great Depression. Then he got drafted into World War II and went through that. Came home, settled suburbia, you know, the baby boom, raised an entire generation. I mean, it's pretty badass.
Oh, yeah. You know? Absolutely, yeah.
That's, and I think in our culture today, like, that's lacking. Men aren't what they used to be. And I'm not saying men should be walking around smoking cigarettes, beating their wives, and drinking themselves to death like they did back in the 50s. Not all of them, but many of them. I'm not saying that, but there's something about that generation where there was a sense of responsibility. Like, you knew what you needed to do. Take care of your family, bring home the paycheck. And I'm not saying that women can't do that. I'm saying that generation had qualities that are lacking today. We can learn a lot from them. We've improved on a lot, but I feel like we can also learn many values from that generation.
Meanwhile, it's frowned upon to beat your wife.
Yes.
For example.
Yeah, leave that out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Leave that out. But I mean, it, I don't know. I think that that's it is just such a different time period. And the fact that those people are still alive today, mm-hmm. although I just read about 700 of them die every day. Okay. My grandpa died last year.
Right.
And they keep dying off. I think the fact that there's that link is so cool. Like, there's no connection to the Civil War. No one's alive from that. You know,
right.
World War II, we've got this entire generation of people that are still here, and we can learn from them.
Is there, a historical figure that you appreciate the most? Or, you know, similar thing as far as, like, favorite time period, favorite historical figure?
No!
Well,
my
yeah, it's all right.
Sorry.
Let's just acknowledge that. My dog tried to eat my wife's chocolate fudge, and she had to scold the dog.
Certainly.
All right. Anyway, historical figure, top of the list, Theodore Roosevelt. And I know that's kind of a cliche. Like, he's kind of like the Chuck Norris of the turn of the century, you know? Like, there's so many memes about Roosevelt. It's a little cliche, but really, he's kind of like the ultimate American. You know, think about the values that he embodies. First of all, conservationism. We wouldn't have the national park system without him. Also, self-improvement. Like, he was born with debilitating asthma, and he was kind of a runt. Like, he should have died in childbirth, and yet he improved his body. He worked out, and he just got more healthy. So self-improvement, and mentally also, self-improvement mentally. And when I say the American dream, I think that's part of it. Like, back centuries ago, before America, there was no dream. Like, you're born a peasant, you die a peasant. You know, you have no land, you're never going to get land. You have no money, you're never going to get money. Like, you know, think of the Irish, right? There's no hope for anything. That's why they left.
Right.
In America, the American dream is supposed to mean you can improve yourself socially, economically, physically, whatever, mentally. And he did that. So that's very admirable. Also,
anything as far as like the presidency goes, or
well, he didn't stand for social injustice. I mean, every president prior to Roosevelt was kind of in the pocket of big business. Government sided with business all the time. So whenever workers would go on strike for a wage increase or something, the government would call in the National Guard to put it down, you know. And Roosevelt said, well, no, the government's here to serve the people, not 15 billionaires, you know.
Right.
It's here to serve the American people. So he enacted legislation to help the common man, and I think that's very admirable, you know.
Mm-hmm. And obviously the conservationism that he did as well.
Yeah.
There's another part of history that I wanted to touch upon before we moved on to other things. It's something that I know that you're super intrigued about. Something that every single year it seems like you try to outdo yourself. And that's Halloween.
Yes.
You are
yes.
Probably the biggest Halloween freak that I know. And you get excited about it usually around this time every single year.
It's true.
And every single year, it's you have a big Halloween party, and we have a lot of fun. It's always rooted in the history of Halloween, which if you could just give us a very brief overview.
Oh, yeah.
Of,
well,
like, the roots of it.
Well, I mean, the roots of Halloween are linked with my passion for Halloween and my childhood experiences with Halloween. It's all intertwined. I mean, the historical part of it, it's been accepted as an Irish holiday. Some say Scottish. We could just say Gaelic.
Okay.
But most people say Irish. It's pagan. And by that I mean it predates Christianity. And in ancient Celtic Ireland, they had four seasons, like we do. And they divided those quarters into halves. And there was the light half and the dark half. I guess you would say, kind of like we have spring, summer versus the dark half, fall, winter.
Okay.
The dark half of their calendar included Samhain. Samhain was October 31st. That was the point in the year where the boundary between the world of the living and the world of the dead was at its thinnest. And that meant that it was way too easy for spirits to cross into our world and vice versa.
Is there a reasoning for why they thought that was the time of the year?
Well, I mean, today we acknowledge fall starts, what, September 21st?
Whatever. Something around the 24th, maybe. I might be just thinking of Kitty's birthday, though.
Well, December 21st is winter, so like November. Yeah, September 21st, around that time.
Yeah.
Right, 22nd, whatever.
And that's generally when, like, when leaves die, things start to get drearier.
You got to remember the ancient Irish were cattle herders. Like they were a culture of horses and cattle. So when the pasture was done and the grass would stop growing, then you can't feed your cattle anymore and your horses. So I mean, this is just an educated guess. Maybe that occurred at the end of October.
So likely you would have to kill them for food.
Right.
And just because you wouldn't be able to feed them anymore
anyway. and why do you think the biggest, wildest parties are always like around Christmas time?
Right.
It's because you slaughter your animals. You know, traditionally, you can't keep them anymore, so you would slaughter them. And plus, there's no crops to take care of anymore. And it's dark really early, so you've got all this food and nothing to do. So, you know, party.
Let's get messed up.
Right. That's where it all originates from, totally. Mm-hmm. But at that point, October 31st, that's when they believed that spirits could cross into our world. And so it was a frightening time. You know, it was a time where spirits could wreak havoc on your animals and your crops. So to placate these spirits, you would put out offerings on the stoop. So if they passed by your home, they would take the treats and then move on. And some people say that that's where trick-or-treating comes from.
Mm-hmm.
It's debatable. Because trick-or-treating itself, as we know it, didn't really come about until the 1930s. But people do like to find a link between those two events.
Right.
And I might add that Christmas caroling is also originated in that tradition of leaving treats for evil spirits.
Because evil spirits tended to come around that particular... around Christmas?
Or? Well, remember, October 31st is very close to December 6th, which is I can't remember what it was, but it's a pagan holiday that's linked with Christmas.
Gotcha.
It all falls into the dark half of the year. So Halloween, right. Christmas, you know, it's all linked.
So just in general, you're like, people are leaving out treats all the time.
Yeah. I mean, it gets dark early, you know, you're scared. I mean, there's no street lamps, there's no electricity, so it's a frightening time, you know?
Right.
You can't see your hand in front of your face on a moonless night. So yeah, people would leave out treats to take care of the spirits. And Christmas caroling used to be called wassailing, which is when you would go from door to door and pretty much beg for treats or wassail in exchange for a Christmas carol.
Which is also something that... another big party that you throw, another thing that you love to do. Which is a fantastic time whenever I'm able to make it to the wassailing party. Our hands are just so cold, like it's impossible to play guitar. We do the best we can. Everything's going out of tune. But like everyone's still in high spirits, and everyone's just knocking on random people's doors.
Oh, yeah.
And we eventually go into the town of Patchogue, and it's an awesome time. And then we come back, and we actually have the traditional wassail, which is... I don't remember.
Traditionally... Well, the word wassail is washail, which means to life, or it's an Anglo-Saxon term, wassail, and it's supposed to have like eggs, like egg whites, and mixed with cloves, and it's weird. I always wanted to try it, but Eric Schmalenberger, who is my brother-in-law, he's the keeper of the wassail. He makes it every year, and he never does that, so. That's fine. But we resort to an Americanized version of wassail, which is like cloves, cinnamon, apples, a little bit of orange juice.
It's just like a really elaborate cider.
Yeah. It's really good.
It's fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
I did touch upon Patchogue just a second ago. Your yearly Patch Out Pope crawls, they've gotten pretty popular. Is there anything new that we have to look forward to? Have you been thinking about this yet?
Well, there will be a baby.
There will
this
be
one.
A baby.
Yeah.
Which, all right.
Yeah, Allison's going to push him around in a little carriage.
Okay.
So Robert IV will be at the next history crawl.
He'll be around.
Other than that, the Four Corners, they're putting up the new building where the Sweezy's building used to be.
Right.
That's not going to be done until next summer. So, I mean, that's kind of new.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the tour goes, we're going to Hoptron this year because that wasn't
that's
open
true.
Last year, right?
Yeah, yeah, very good.
That wasn't even open. So we're going to go to Hoptron, which is, by the way, now it's my favorite place in Patchogue.
It's great.
It's my favorite.
It's so much fun to hang out there.
I brag to everybody about it at work. Like, that's all I talk about. In fact, today at work, we're grading the regents, and someone says, "Hey, Rob, you." They call me Rob at work.
Yeah.
Let me pause there for a second.
Yeah.
They call me Rob. I started to introduce myself as Rob at work, so my real friends know me as Bob.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, anyway, that's a whole other story, but... he says, "Hey, Rob, you live in Patchogue. What's that new place, Hoptron? You ever go in there?" And he doesn't know that. Like, I'm obsessed with Hoptron.
Right.
So I happen to have gift certificates in my pocket because Chris and Gina and Allison's parents got me gift cards there. And I was going to stop there after work so I can pick up drinks for this interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, funny you ask, because boom, gift cards. I'm going there today."
Nice.
So Hoptron will be on the tour this year. Absolutely.
Awesome. It's yeah. great. I probably like it so much because it's quiet.
Yeah.
So you can sit down and have a conversation with somebody and have a really good beer. And you're not mobbed. You're not yelling over loud music.
Because it's not a bar.
Right.
It has a bar in it, but right. it's not a bar.
Technically correct. Yeah. Absolutely. With the pub crawl, did you ever have any ideas of like getting in touch with the town of Patchogue, getting in touch with the local like bar owners to be like, "Hey, I'm doing this thing. I get a lot of people down. Like, I'll bring them to your bar. Give us some deals, or you know, it's some kind of way of advertising it or monetizing it or anything like that." Has that ever crossed your mind, at least?
It has crossed my mind, but I've never acted upon it. First of all, it's very successful on its own. All I do is I post it on Facebook and I say, "Share this with everyone." You know,
mm-hmm.
I put it on the Patchogue Patch Facebook, and then people show up, and it's mostly either friends or friends of friends.
Right.
And that's great. That's fine. If I get government involved, like local government, Patchogue Village, I don't know. I mean, I'm afraid then it would become a situation where you would have to be licensed or...
There are particular guidelines that they have to
Yeah, like
by.
Zoning laws and things like that. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I want to do that.
It's also... We're just having a good time with ourselves. And that's great in and of itself. I was just curious if you plan on taking it anywhere besides
that. You know what it is? I'm not trying to sound pretentious.
Absolutely
not. I'm really not. But I like the fact that it's a grassroots movement. And I like the fact that maybe you can call it like a guerrilla bar hopping experience.
I'll call it that.
Because once you involve Suffolk County or Patchogue Village...
The government, man.
Yeah. And then you're also looking at, like, liability. Like, what if Tim Fitzpatrick trips on the curb and then he's going to sue Mr. Bob giving the tour, you know? Like, things like that, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's not a business. So I've thought about it, but the fact that it's grassroots and it's off the cuff, whoever wants to show up, I think it's cool. I don't know if I want to go any further than that.
It's about as good as it gets anyway, so It's an awesome time. And actually, it was, if I can get into a little bit of my own personal history, the first one that you had was kind of that was the catalyst for me and my current girlfriend, Christina.
Oh, yeah.
Getting together, because she popped in near the end of it, and we had had enough drinks to kind of, you know, express our feelings towards each other, and the rest is history. So I guess In a sense, I have you to thank for that.
Patchogue history.
Patchogue history.
The rest is Patchogue history.
Exactly. most interesting tidbit of Patchogue history very quickly.
Oh, man. There's a lot. Could I elaborate on that before I answer the question?
Absolutely.
First of all, it's local history. And some people would say, who cares about that? Like, why don't we take our time to study American history or world history? But the thing is that so much of our local history makes up the larger national history. So, like, for example, like, Allison and I have been going to Huntington because our midwife is located there. And, man, it's like every time you turn a corner, there's some historical marker, and Revolutionary War history is big in Huntington, like on the North Shore. And so, like, if it wasn't for the people of these small towns, you wouldn't have had these epic events in history. Like, the people, the folk, you know, the folk history. Like, that, where are the cogs and the gears that turn the machine of national or world history?
So if you're looking for the roots...
Yeah, yeah.
Of everything, of all of the big events right. that happened in world history, this is where it all started.
Well, I mean, what would you rather read? A statement... In 100 years, would you rather read a statement issued by the president, or a diary entry, or a blog from Tim Fitzpatrick?
100% the blog from Tim Fitzpatrick.
Like, or actually, like, you know, this right here. Like, what are we doing? What are we doing today? Like, mm-hmm. I think this in 100 years, if this is preserved in some way, I think
I'll do my best to take care of it.
You can learn. I think you can learn a lot about early 21st century Long Island by checking out Tim's podcast, if it's preserved in some way, you know?
Again, I'll do the best I can, try to keep track of all my hard drives. I'll put on an external, because this is something that I'm actually really, really excited about. Not mm-hmm. only, like, am I interviewing super interesting people about it, I am kind of making that keepsake from a really cool time in my life, mm-hmm. which hopefully I'll be able to look back on and, you know, see with very fond memories. So that should be very exciting and very, very good Patchogue memories, because mm-hmm. who knows if I'll be living in Patchogue for forever. So again, most interesting
right.
Tidbit of Patchogue history.
Okay. It's a tough call because there's a lot. I mean, first of all, we all know the Four Corners.
Of course. Well, not we all.
No, we all do. Yes, we do.
Everyone in this house currently...
Everyone
knows a Four Corners. There's not that many people who know the Four Corners.
That is a good point.
Patchogue.
Okay, let's back it up then.
Yes, please.
Montauk Highway and North Ocean Avenue. North of Montauk is North Ocean, and then south of Montauk is South Ocean Avenue.
Makes sense.
Some landmarks. You've got the budget buy and sell on the... It's a landmark.
Some historical landmark.
Well, actually, that's the tidbit. Is many of us know the budget buy and sell on the southeast corner, which has the big clock on it. That originally was a cemetery. In the early 19th century, was a cemetery.
Right smack dab in that corner.
Well, because at that time, Patchogue was more of like the Wild West. You know, it was really just like a. There was nothing here. There were about 70 houses in Patchogue in the early 1800s. It was just a stopover on the way to Brooklyn. That's all
okay.
It was.
Where were people coming out from?
The Hamptons, Sag Harbor.
Okay. Oh well, yeah. Sag Harbor was a big town because of the whaling industry.
Right.
Right. So they were coming from
yeah.
Sag Harbor,
and then Brooklyn. I mean, Patchogue historically is known as this big vacation getaway in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when you had the big hotels going up and the trolley cars. I'm talking before that, like
right.
nothing. There were 70 houses. It was more akin to the Wild West. And at that point, it was an outpost. You know what I mean? It's like going to like the Badlands today.
Right.
And that corner was a cemetery. Once Patchogue started to mature, people realized, well, that's good real estate. So, of course, the natural thing to do is dig up the bodies.
Of course.
And
because nothing bad ever happened when you dug up a body.
The bodies were transferred to a lot that was on south of Roe Boulevard, close to St. Joseph's College, on the south side.
Which is still there.
Mm-hmm. You mean the college?
Not the college, the cemetery.
Oh, the lot is still there, but it's overgrown. It's woods now, overlooking the lake.
Gotcha.
The reason why there's nothing there but trees is because the bodies were naturally dug up a second time and transferred and transferred to their current location, which is actually within my sight from my dining room window. Cedar Grove Cemetery.
So that's the final resting spot of the people who lived in the Four Corners.
Right, where the budget buy and sell.
Well, the presumably final resting spot until they decide, like, we're going to put up, you know, a Denny's. Dig up the bodies again.
Yeah, yeah. Which is why, like, I just love Susquehanna. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I love that song. I always think of that.
For those who don't know, Susquehanna is a song by a band called Defiance Ohio, who you can get all of their music for free on if you just Google Defiance Ohio. And it's essentially about... Bob, you probably know a little bit more about how to explain it than I do, if you could get a little bit into that.
Well, I think, like, to summarize it, it's about many things. I mean, urban sprawl, globalization, modernization, and the chorus of the song, I guess you would say, right,
mm-hmm.
is, and I wonder, what do they do with the bodies? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but when the guys in the band were growing up, they saw bodies transferred from a cemetery to another location because of development.
Right.
Right. And this is almost 200 years ago, but same situation, you know, like the almighty dollar trumps burials and sanctity of
right.
the body.
Exactly. And actually, the thing that probably is, you know, the best part of this song, while it is touching on, you know, globalization and industry and urban sprawl, it puts it in kind of a personal sense, because this is all coming from their personal experiences, and they're seeing, you know, something that was a stream, you know, paved over and turned into a parking lot and a Sunoco and stuff like that.
Oh yeah.
And so it's a very good song if you guys have an opportunity to check it out if you haven't yet. Defiance Ohio, honestly, one of my favorite bands of all time. So check them out. I guess while we're on the topic of music, the Red Season is unfortunately no more. Are there plans for future? Because obviously you're one of the best drummers that I know. Are there plans for future bands, or do you just kind of want to do something at some point?
Well, after Chris left the Red Season, my time was short because I'm having my first child in July. The band ended before then, but, you know, with the baby coming, definitely don't have time for music or performing music immediately. But as soon as I possibly can get back onto a drum set, I'm going to start playing again.
Right.
I can't really function without playing music. It's really, really painful not to play music.
And you've been doing it all your life. And
yeah.
Like to have that, you know, to have that part of your life taken away,
yeah.
even though it's for something as fantastic.
Yeah, it's temporary.
As,
it's okay.
As your son. It's
temporary.
And it's totally understandable.
You know, once we get the diaper changing down and all that, like, we'll start playing again. I mean, in some capacity, I just have to play again. There's no way I'll stop. Till the day I die, I'm going to be playing drums.
Right.
I have to.
So, I guess I actually have this note written down. you don't know what kind of band you're going to be involved in. And I always see, like, and Dad, if you're listening to this, I doubt you are. No offense, of course. I see guys like my dad who, at my age, they were making original music. They were writing these cool groovy rock songs. Always Beatles inspired because, you know, Beatles and Billy Joel inspired because that's all my dad ever listens to. But they were doing original stuff. As we get older, is that creative drive still going to be around, or are you just going to want to play for the sake of playing and you'll play whatever?
Both.
So you still have that creative drive.
Yeah.
If someone is around to play with you, someone who has that creative drive to build around those drums that you have, you still are totally okay with writing stuff with them.
Of course. Oh yeah. Well, what's the alternative? You mean covering songs?
Yeah, absolutely. Cover bands.
No, both.
Which, I mean, while the other band that we were in, the Fian, did do original stuff, I mean, for the most part, we even started in that direction of being a cover band. While it was a cover band with a twist, because not a lot of people do Irish stuff, you know, we're essentially doing cover songs.
Right.
And, you know, we already took the step in that direction. Do you see yourself going further in that way? Are you just kind of, it seems like you're just kind of like, I'll play whatever.
No, I mean, I always want to create. I'm upset that I don't play a melodic instrument where I can write a song. But whenever we cover a song, I'm not going to play it the same way that the drummer from that band played it.
Another note that I had, one of the reasons why I loved playing with you is because even if we did do a cover, it was never the same. not only never the same from the cover that we were doing, the original song, never the same twice in a row, because you always had something new to add to it. You know, good or bad, sometimes, you know, it slowed the song down and stuff, but for the most part, it made it super exciting to play with you, because you never knew what was going to happen next. Yeah.
Well, I think in the future that I'll still be doing that same thing. I mean, when I was growing up, and to this day, my biggest percussive influence was Dave Matthews Band and their drummer Carter Beauford. In the African tradition, or African American tradition, would improv, and every time Dave Matthews Band plays a song, it's never the same.
Right.
I mean, look at some of their songs from like '96. They start out as like 3 minute studio tracks, and then in today in 2013, they're like 25 minute long songs, which some people don't like.
I would say there are a lot of people who don't like that. But
but as a musician or drummer, I like that because it shows growth, it shows evolution and creativity. And that's why I can never play a song the same way as it is in the studio. And I think that's the way music has been for thousands of years, is that you, in the folk tradition, you learn a song from your parents or from someone in your tribe, and then when you perform it, you put your own two cents in.
You maybe add a verse.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Right. That's why I love folk music and I love Dave Matthews Band. It's all the same. Like, it's growth. It's folk, you know? I mean, folk in the sense of it's the people adding their own improv.
Right. Which, I don't know if you have any kind of opinion on this, but the word folk gets thrown around a lot.
Yeah.
Now. Be it good or bad, because there are a lot of good folk bands out there. I mean, Mumford & Sons, bless their souls, they write fantastic music, but you wouldn't...
Yeah,
I don't necessarily call them...
Well, they're mainstream now.
The music of the people.
Of course.
Do you still feel that connection with the title of folk, or are you just... Would you feel comfortable really defining anything as folk as long as it's just...
If you go...
Not necessarily a DIY thing, but similar to a DIY thing.
Okay, well, I mean, look at the word folk itself. German, right? Volk. I mean, the people. And back centuries ago, you had the music of the people, that was being composed in barns and fields, you know. It was really uncouth and raw. And on the other end of the spectrum, you had music that was being composed for princes and emperors. And it was
what's polished. The
word? It was polished. It was contracted or
corporate, man.
Yeah, it was almost like 17th century corporate. You know, like it was like patronage. You know,
right?
Even look at the great Renaissance artists. Like they had the de Medici family of Italy was funding Da Vinci and Michelangelo, and that's not folk.
Right.
You know, I think folk. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like the great classical artists, that's genius. That's amazing. But I'm just drawn more to the folk. I want to hear what people are writing in their barns, like, and in the year 2013, instead of barns, we have basements.
Right.
So instead of emperors and princes that are patronizing musicians, we have Lady Gaga or Justin Bieber, and instead of people composing music in fields and barns, we have garage bands. That's the new folk.
Right. So it's not necessarily the, you know, the title of folk that makes a band folk too. It's
yeah,
well, it's where it's coming from. It's the kind of person that's making it.
Yeah, because the problem is the word folk has been appropriated.
Right.
Like you said, Mumford and Sons, who I love, but they're not folk anymore in the tradition, in the classical sense.
Right.
Because it's become mainstream, so it's no longer folk. Therefore,
exactly. Is there any particular band that's sticking out to you right now, be it folk or not folk? Folk in the traditional sense or folk in the current sense? Have you been listening to anything good recently?
Lately, I've been reading The Land Where the Blues Begin by Alan Lomax. And for anybody who's not familiar with Lomax, get familiar with Lomax, because he's not even a musician. He was contracted by the government to go to the Deep South back in the 30s and the 40s and go down dirt trails in like Arkansas, Mississippi, the Delta. Go down like dirt trails in Jim Crow South and just set up an old recorder, record player, phonograph, and just let these anonymous black musicians go to town, you know?
And that sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's really incredible. And a lot of people don't realize that folk music that he recorded is the basis for a lot of rock and roll. Like, that's what those gems that he captured in the Delta went on to influence the Beatles, the Rolling Stones. And that's what I've been getting into recently. And honestly, like, I haven't had the time, but I want to get his anthology. And I haven't done that yet. A lot of his stuff is online. If you go online, it's called Allison, what's it called? The World Jukebox? The Global, right? Global Jukebox?
Allison is making one of those faces like, Bob. No idea.
All right. Okay. Well, for the listeners, if you just Google the words Lomax, that's L-O-M-A-X, and the word Global Jukebox, you'll find it. And it's just like this digital archive of his field recordings. It's just incredible. You know, like harmonicas, banjos, and stomping the floor, spoons, playing the spoons. Folk music.
Right.
So that's what I've been trying to get into more.
Interesting. A lot of the stuff that we were talking about kind of stems from, like we had said, why local history intrigues you so much is because that's where the global history stems from.
Mm-hmm. It's folk history.
This might be why folk music intrigues you so much, is because that's where all of the really cool or the hip music comes from today, is from the underground stuff. And like you said, a lot of the stuff that Lomax had found influenced arguably the biggest band ever in the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and stuff like that. So, you know, it seems like you're really into not necessarily the big picture, but the reason for the big picture. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, I've always been interested more in the origin of something rather than the thing itself.
Right.
Even like, I don't know, like, I guess I'd be more interested in like Wolverine origins as opposed to just X-Men.
Would you say that that was a better movie than X-Men?
I don't know. I never saw it.
Oh, okay. Well, I would imagine that I would. When you watch it, Bob.
But I will be. I will be more interested.
Presumably. a couple of extra questions I have for you. Obviously, you're a big world traveler. You guys, you and Allison, go all over the world as much as possible. Is there anything, A, that you're planning on doing anytime soon, or have things been kind of put on side for baby Rob?
In the future, obviously we're not going to travel with a one-year-old, because we've...
That's fine, man. I've seen it done before.
Well, that's wrong.
Agreed, you should not. I've seen it done before.
Don't put your baby on an airplane. You're a horrible person. Oh, yeah. What baby would not love an 8-hour flight across the Atlantic Ocean? I mean,
sitting in one spot for hours on end.
It's great. Once he's old enough, I mean, I like I said before, I want to share my pleasures with the baby when he's old enough. Like I said, movies, music, and all that. And travel is included. And Allison and I, would really love to share travel with Robert Junior when he's of age. When he's old enough to appreciate it, we want to take him to as many places as we can to get a well-rounded global cultural experience. I think one of the first places would be the Navajo Reservation in New Mexico. Allison and I, we know this guy through St. John's Youth Ministry, friend of a friend, actually, Marion's friend.
Mm-hmm.
He does these retreats in Nicaragua and New Mexico, and we were going to go to New Mexico to do charity work on the reservation, but we got in too late and the flights doubled in price, so we couldn't go. Instead, we went to Paris. Not charity. But when Robert Jr. is old enough, we really want him to be a good person. What parent doesn't want their kid to be a good person? So I think the first travel experience would be nice is to take him to the reservation and have him meet people from a different culture and do charity work, building the infrastructure, housing, and whatnot. I think that's fantastic. I think that would be the first big trip. And then after that, I think number two would be
Disney.
Well, oh God. Yeah, we could hit every...
Do you have a thing against Disney, or...?
Yeah, I guess I do.
Alright, no, I mean, I completely understand, I suppose I would understand someone's reasons for it. I am kind of still in love with the magic of it, even though I haven't been in, like, 8 years or so. What's your thing against Disney, man?
I think... Listen, don't get me wrong, I'm not being arrogant. If you put me on a plane and sent me to Disney World, I would have a good time. Okay? But in the big picture, it's a large agent of globalization and McDonaldization and fabrication. It's not real. So instead of taking your child to a Navajo reservation or the top of a mountain, you take him to Disney World. Instead of taking your kid to Bavaria, you take him to Germany
and Epcot.
In Epcot. You're like, instead of taking your kid to Paris, you go to the France and Epcot.
Close approximation, right?
It's just fake. It's like living in the Matrix. Like, this is not real. So why would you settle for second best? You could do the real thing. Like, Space Mountain is really cool, but
would you rather be in space?
launch your child into outer space.
That's a very good point, Bob. I've never saw it that way.
No, every kid needs to be a kid.
Right.
I don't think there's any harm in taking your kid to Disney World once But there are some people who are like, let's go back a 13th time or a 14th time.
My aunt and uncle do that. They go once or twice a year. And obviously, because I'm a fan of Disney regardless of the obvious, you know, sterilization of culture that it is. But there's still something... It sounds cliche to say magical about it, but it feels magical. And my aunt and uncle, when they come back, it's as good as the first time they've been there. So Disney, ABC, whoever else is tied in that conglomerate, I'm open for sponsorships. I love Disney. Bob is not open for sponsorships because Bob hates magic.
Well, I prefer real magic, like the joy of walking through a real rainforest instead of one that's underneath a dome at Epcot, you know. Or
that's fair. Is that really a thing? Oh, you haven't been, have you?
What?
We have an actual rainforest dome.
Well, think of like maybe the Rainforest Cafe. I'm thinking, right. You know, that's not really a rainforest, you know.
No, I guess you're right.
And I've been to Disney when I was in fifth grade, and I had a blast. Like, it was a lot of fun. But I'm saying, like, do it once, and then I feel like the world is so huge, and the price of a ticket to Europe or anywhere else is not much more than a flight to Florida, depending on the time of the year.
Honestly, me and Christina were looking at flights to Florida, and they cost about as much as we paid to go to San Francisco.
Right.
So
I just feel like life is so short. Go explore your planet, you know? Mm-hmm. I have nothing. I'm not a diehard hater of Disney. You know, it's like Walmart, you know. I hate Walmart. I hate it. But you know, I've shopped there.
You know? Do you really?
I don't go there. No, I mean like I you know, like
be there.
What? No, I'm not.
You've like, seen in Walmart, but you want their fantastic prices.
No, but some people are like loyal fans of mm-hmm. things like that, and like, you know, I'll shop on Main Street or whatever. But if I'm passing Vets Highway and oh shit, I need eggs, you know, that lawn chair, you know, okay, I'll run in and get it. But it's not my first choice.
If you need eggs, there's a Stop and Shop like right next door to that Walmart, man.
I mean, remember the Walmart they wanted to put in East Patchogue?
Absolutely.
Remember that?
Yes. Oh, yeah. We fought really hard against that. Yeah. I am obviously a staunch, I guess, enemy of Walmart.
So what's the difference between Walmart and Disney?
No, that's my point.
Well, you know what? I've read up. For those who didn't necessarily hear Allison on that, she's asking what the difference is between Walmart and Disney, and I say, I don't know, but I've read more about the evils of Walmart, and like, Walmart doesn't have fucking Space Mountain, man.
Like, not yet.
Not yet. I'm sure they'll have one in the next couple of years in, like, the big ones that also have, like, like the food court. But, yes, I recognize that Disney is very similar to Walmart, but from personal experience, I've experienced worse from Walmart than I have from Disney. I've only experienced joy from Disney. Have you heard anything? Obviously, you're probably a little bit more involved in local politics than I am.
Yeah, it's been dead for a while.
It has been.
But not forgotten. They haven't forgotten about that location. Mm-hmm. But I guess they kind of put it on pause for a long time.
Gotcha. I talked a lot during this podcast. I apologize.
Well, no, that's natural. It's a conversation.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is a conversation. Right. I suppose it's a little bit more of a conversation than like your standard interview type of discussion. I'd like to introduce my this new segment that I have, this brand new segment on my second episode, and that's listener questions. And this question comes from...
This is fantastic, by the way. Love this. I love it.
Good. I'm glad you're enjoying it. This question comes from M Record in Columbus, Ohio. M Record asks, why did you leave Grieving for Grace? And how has your outlook on music changed since leaving Grieving for Grace?
Wow.
Grieving for Grace, for those who don't know, is not your first band, but your first big band.
Hmm. Okay, well, first of all, to start off, I want to say that it's been a musical roller coaster. In high school, I was in Rapture, which played classic rock, a lot of classic rock.
You did classic rock, but you put a Christian twist on it, or a Catholic twist on it?
Nope.
No?
That's just because the word rapture is
a Christian word. It's a Christian word, but
No.
You know, I'm digressing a little bit too much.
Continue. No, that's all right. It's no, it was just straight up classic rock. It was just a bunch of 16-year-olds playing Led Zeppelin.
Gotcha.
And Eric Clapton, that's all it was.
Right.
And it was awesome. I loved it. We had a lot of fun. And I kind of honed my skills at that point. Mm-hmm. Broke up, high school over. Joined Grieving for Grace with Jay Miller and George Montanay, and then later on Brett Stefani, who did not go to Connecticut. And at that point, we were still playing, like, Jay Miller was big into, like, Goo Goo Dolls and a lot of late 90s, early 2000s rock, like Third Eye Blind and such. And, like, we had a lot of fun. We played at the Funky Fish a lot in Bayshore.
The Funky Fish keeps getting brought up on my podcast. I have never gone to that place.
Oh, it was, for a college kid, it was pretty cool.
It was the end all be all, right?
It was a lot of fun, yeah. Yep. So, it was a lot of fun. At first, we were very unpolished and raw, and I liked that. It was a lot of fun. And then we hooked up with this producer who had big dreams, like, you're going to make it big, kiddo, you know, that kind of thing. And I guess...
Punching the shoulder just a little too hard.
Yeah. So, at that point, we got too polished and became very adult contemporary. And Jay Miller, excellent songwriter. Like, very good songwriter. Amazing. But I think as time went on, the music just became too polished for my taste from the producer's perspective. Like, he was ordering. In fact, I remember at one point I heard secondhand the producer told the band that I need to tone it down on the drums. And said, you know, Bob's got to understand, this ain't the Carter Beauford show. Carter Beauford, you know, Dave Matthews Band
right,
drummer,
yeah, like,
biggest influence on my drums. Yeah, he's got to tone it down. This ain't the Carter Beauford show.
But even like his band, the band that he's in, is named after another person.
So that was kind of the beginning of the end, and I was just so bored playing. I mean, in the Fane, if I play like, name a song.
Any song that we played?
Yeah.
If I Should Fall from Grace with God.
Yeah, if I played that the way the Pogues played it, I'd be kind of bored.
That's
so
boring as shit, man.
I put my own Fleming spin on it, and I loved it. In Grieving for Grace, they didn't want that spin. They wanted the way it sounded. They wanted like a metronome. They wanted a drum machine.
Right. It was if you deviated from that, you would be talked down out of doing something.
Yeah.
Like scolded. At all?
Well, yeah. Yeah, because they wanted a radio-friendly... We were trying to really get out there, you know? And they wanted a radio-friendly product. And I guess my improv didn't make it radio-friendly. So that was a big problem. And also, like, college was over at that point. I was starting my new career, and things were kind of falling apart. And I just told them I was getting bored. And they said, well, we don't want somebody in the band who's bored. So maybe you shouldn't be in the band anymore. Yeah, rather than give me more creativity, I was removed from the band. So I don't have any hard feelings about it today. That was over 10 years ago.
You and Jay Miller are still friends. You
yeah.
Still
oh, of course. Right? We're actually hanging out with Jay Miller and his wife Stephanie next week. So
awesome.
Yeah, no hard feelings. But that's why I left the band. And at that point, I feel like this was my musical awakening. Because I've always been very jazz, funk oriented. And funny, I've never been in a funk band or anything like that. But
not yet.
Not yet. But after Grieving for Grace, I had a few years hiatus. And at that point, my brother Chris said, "Hey, Bob. You know Tim Fitzpatrick, Mike Goldense?" I said, "Yeah, I know of Tim, and I've hung out with Mike, yeah." "Oh, well, you want to play some music?" So I remember we, what was it, 2007?
Let's see, yeah. I had just turned 21, I think.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, I think 2007.
I have it carved in the wall in the basement, remember?
Yeah, in that on the pole.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
So if we went downstairs to check it out, but fuck it.
By the way, side note, I'm finishing the basement to turn it into a playroom for the baby. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make sure that when it's finished, that graffiti where we listed.
It's got to be left there.
I'm going to leave that as a window. Yeah, awesome. I'm going to leave that.
Very cool.
But when, anyway, when Tim and Mike came over, we played some music. And at that point, I was less interested in making music and I guess more interested in being in a band with friends. And at first glance, you might say, well, that's not smart, you know. That's going to hold you back. What if your friends are not into the same kind of music as you? Or
talented.
Yeah, all sorts of variables, right? But no, I disagree, because I feel like when you know somebody personally, then your drive and your passion to make the music is that much stronger. And now, today, the next band that I'm in, I don't really want to be. I would have a lot of fun playing in a, like a funk or jazz band, but if I don't know the people, I don't think it would be as good. And it turns out like a lot of my friends that I'm close with don't play funk or jazz. They play folk punk, punk rock, and I'm fine with that because I can introduce an element of funk and jazz.
Exactly, which is something that I always really enjoyed in the Red Season is that Chris and Mike always had either some kind of folk or some kind of punk feel to anything they wrote.
Mm-hmm.
But you always threw in like a curveball there, which was great. Made the songs a lot more interesting than they would have been. Unfortunately, we have, and this is coming from M Record in Columbus, Ohio, the most unlistenable album that he's ever heard.
What, the Red Season?
Quote. Yes.
Pirate House Weapon Music?
Pirate House Weapon Music.
Because of the quality of the recording?
Because of the quality of the... Yeah.
Well, that's
not
why
it's... Not because of the quality of the songs.
That's what makes it folk.
Exactly.
If you listen... Go back to Lomax, Alan Lomax, his field recordings from the 30s, horrible quality. You know? It's some sharecropper, like, twanging with a banjo, and that's what makes it good.
You're going to have to take this up with M Record.
I will, M Record. He's... whoever you are out there.
Columbus, Ohio. He said that it seems like we went out of our way to make it sound unlistenable. Which, while we didn't necessarily do that, we were all so ignorant about the recording process.
No, so it was genuine.
Right, yeah. It was folk as folk gets, man. That it did sound that bad. If you don't mind, I'm going to look... at my, I'm gonna look at the Facebook post I made to be sure that we didn't miss any questions here. Have you ever played Castlevania naked?
I've done many things naked. Shower, intercourse, reading, watching Eddie Murphy stand up.
Is that a fact or is that a joke?
Which one?
The Eddie Murphy stand-up one. And if so, is there a story behind that?
That is a joke.
Oh, man.
Yep. That is a joke.
Okay, that's fine. A good joke, though.
Thank you. Castlevania naked? No. Never played Castlevania naked. Video games naked? I'm sure it's happened. But
guilty.
As yeah, we've all done that. But no, never Castlevania specifically naked. I played much Castlevania clothed. I was talking to Tim over dinner before the recording. I guess the closest I've ever come would be. I just have these nice memories of being in fifth grade, and not a care in the world, and waking up over the summer, jumping in my pool, swimming around in the sun, getting out, drying off, and going upstairs and just playing Star Tropics on the NES for the whole afternoon, and then that's it. That was my summer, and good memories. But my point is, I was playing in a bathing suit.
So it was never nude.
No, just a bathing suit. Not totally nude.
Let's see here. Any other relevant questions? R. Marino from Bayshore, New York asks, history?
We've already covered that in depth.
Exactly, R. Yeah. Marino.
Moving on.
M. Kovacs, also from Bayshore, New York, asks, Radiohead?
Well, Radiohead. What about Radiohead? I mean, that's an open-ended question.
She basically says, I posted, does anyone have any questions? And M. Kovacs says, most things involving Radiohead, you two haven't debated that enough.
Oh, well,
and
okay.
M. Kovacs, I guarantee you, me and R. Fleming have debated it enough.
Mm-hmm.
We'll agree to disagree. But Rob's wrong.
I have to disagree, actually, with that statement. The fact that I'm wrong. I actually think, I think I'm right. I think Radiohead's music, the thing is that a lot of it is anti-music. At least a lot of their music from Kid A and Hail to the Thief, Amnesiac, it's anti-music. And it's a statement. It's a lot like Dada. This, you know, Dada art movement from post-World War I, which was anti-art. And it was a rebellion against art. Art was always pretentious and hoity-toity. Art was something that art was something reserved for the upper classes, which were responsible for World War I in the eyes of the Dadaists.
Right.
After World War I, you had this lost generation, veterans returning home. What's the point of living? We're all going to kill each other anyway. Life sucks. So, you know, they created this art movement that was anti-aristocratic because art was something for the upper classes. So they said, well, here's an art that's just anti-art. We're going to take the Mona Lisa and we're going to draw a mustache on her. Because fuck art.
Har har.
And I feel like that's Radiohead, like Kid A. They actually created that album to be in rebellion against the machine. You know, the commercial music. And it had the irony is that it was a best-selling album. But it was written to be anti-music. And I think that's really cool. I think that's really rebellious, and I like that.
Well, to be fair, Radiohead, there's already someone who was writing music against the machine, and that was Rage Against the Machine.
Oh, yeah. Come on. He sucks.
Who?
The singer. De La Roca? Is that his name?
What about him?
I don't like him.
Why?
I don't know.
I have a legitimate reason to not like Radiohead.
I don't even know
Zach.
Okay. If maybe I need to give it a second chance because I was a little younger when I listened to it, but I always got the impression that it was he was just angry for the sake of being angry.
If I can be candid with you, yes, he presumably is. The reason why I liked Rage Against the Machine so much, and the reason why I appreciate them now, is that they kind of conveyed anger slightly more eloquently than most of the bands I was listening to at the time. Fucking Limp Bizkit and fucking Korn.
Yeah.
Man. Like,
I can agree with you on that.
Yeah. I mean, they at least dropped names of people who were slightly revolutionary, and as a kid that really intrigued me. And now they just, you know, they wrote rockin' music and they have really good like guitar licks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Tom Morello was a fantastic guitarist.
The songs were good. I like their songs.
They were, exactly. It was a little overwrought, the lyrics and just the whole message behind it, certainly.
See, that's why I like Radiohead, because they're not just musical rebels, but political as well. I mean, after George Bush's election and the war in Iraq, Radiohead became more political. And whether or not I agree with what they were saying, I thought that it was really bold of them and creative to write songs that were political, but they did it without screaming and without yelling. They were just these cold, distant melodies and lyrics that were not in your face. Like, they were protesting without even mentioning Bush or without even mentioning Iraq. Like, they would write songs where you could vaguely say, "Oh, I think that might be about the war."
This is a little profound, man.
I thought that was very tasteful. You know, I thought that was kind
of
cool.
That's fair. Creative. And it's definitely something different than what a lot of the bands at the time were doing. And they were basically saying, you know, again, you know, regardless of how you viewed the situation, like, fuck Bush, fuck the war.
Yeah.
People were literally saying that in songs. And, yeah, certainly Radiohead was doing something different.
Yeah.
I won't go ahead and state my case because it's been stated before numerous times. So we'll save people the boredom of doing that. But Bob, is there anything else you want to touch on before we end this interesting podcast?
Well, I guess I would say that I'm just incredibly excited to be a dad. And I can't wait to share everything that I said in this interview. I can't wait to share that with my son. The music, the travel, the history, the parties, the Halloween parties, the concerts. Like, I can't wait to take him to a concert, you know? All that stuff. I just can't wait to share all that with him. I can't wait to introduce him to my friends and my family. I can't wait for him to be a part of the wassailing. I can't wait for him to be a part of the Halloween party. Like, I think if you want me to talk about, like, have any last words to summarize myself, I would say I'm a very emotional person. I'm very emotional. And that's a detriment in some ways, but it's also beneficial in others. But whenever I drink, I get more emotional. Even when I'm not drinking. You notice when I'm not drinking, I'm emotional, but I try to hide it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not acceptable to be emotional. Like, I'm a man, so I shouldn't be emotional. I shouldn't love people, you know? So when I drink, it comes out more. I think it's important. I think people need to bring that out more, even when they're sober. And I really care so much about my friends and my family, and I'm excited for my son to meet those people and to be around that. And before, Tim, you asked me about Halloween and why do I love Halloween so much. And it's really, the reason is historical. I just think it's a beautiful tapestry of Irish American history, among other cultures, but also socially. It's every Halloween I look forward to it like it's Christmas, because I have my mom, my dad, my in-laws, my brothers, my friends come over, and we eat food together, we drink together, we laugh, like, we just have a good time. And to me, that's the true meaning of Halloween. but also nostalgic value, you know, growing up in the 80s, like, Halloween has a special place in my heart. So that's why I love Halloween so much. It's kind of like a vehicle to express my love for my family and my friends. I don't know. I can keep talking for hours and hours. Is there anything else that you have to ask me? Any other?
You know what? That's everything I have. To no be other comments. With you. My number one comment is Bob. You're one of the most interesting people I've ever met. Thanks so much for being on this. And I texted you yesterday, today being Wednesday when I recorded it, and you said, hold on, I'll get back to you after I finish listening to my child's heartbeat. And apparently this was important enough to Bob for him to take out his phone and respond to me. But actually, that does mean a lot to me. Bob, I always feel the love from you, man. It's been a great time. Thanks so much for being on this. And hopefully I'll have you on another time so you can talk about the awesome times that you've had with your son so far.
Oh, there'll be more?
I'm planning on having more than two, yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
I know, it's going to be great.
You know what's great about this?
What?
It's empowering to people.
How so?
Well, it gives people a voice. Even if the audience is very small, it's just a handful of people, you're still talking to a microphone. It's empowering, and you're sharing your ideas and your thoughts, and you're creating a legacy. Like I said, who knows how long this will be around for. Like, as soon as you post this, I'm going to take the MP3 and put it on my hard drive and save it. So I think it's really empowering to people to give them a voice. And to go back to Lomax, when Alan Lomax would go to these sharecroppers, and I'm not comparing myself to a sharecropper. I'm not saying like we're kindred spirits, but but when Lomax would go to these like dusty roads and these farms and meet these poor black sharecroppers, he'd say, like, talking to the mic, like, play a song for the mic. And they'd say, well, what do you mean? Like, why do you want to hear me? I'm just a sharecropper living in the Delta. Like, what do you want from me? Who cares about me? And Lomax would say, because history is not just written by kings and presidents, it's written by poor people and farmers and factory workers and folk. And that made these people excited, because for once in their life they had a voice. They had a platform, you know, a podium. And I mean, I've had many opportunities to be vocal, so I'm trying not to compare myself too much to these people, but I think the motivation is the same. I think you're acting very much like this guy Lomax did, is that you're giving your friends a platform or an opportunity to speak their mind and immortalize their ideology.
That was kind of the idea, and mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, because this is a great idea.
Thank you. Bob, it's again been awesome having you on, and best of luck in fatherhood, and best of luck on your summer vacation
with a baby.
Summer vacation with a baby. Thanks a lot, dude.
Oh, thank you, Tim.
I appreciate
thanks.
It.
Thanks.
Guys, that was Mr. Bob Fleming. Thanks again, Bob, for being on the podcast. If you care about what Bob has to say, I guess you can look for him on Facebook. He might friend you. Who knows? Robert Fleming is the name that he goes by.
Rob.
He's Rob Fleming? Excuse me. Honestly, you're pretty much off the grid after that, man. Thanks again, guys, for listening, and thanks again, Bob, for being on the show. I had an awesome time. I will catch you next time.